It is Monday, July 12th. This is LA Podcast. I am Alyssa Walker. I'm here with Matt Tinoco and Hayes Davenport. How you doing?
Good. Scott's out this week.
Scott's
rotating
on fire watch.
Vacations in effect. Yeah, Scott is going around the state with a super soaker.
That was what I was doing last weekend, by the way. I was able to take in the fireworks from a safe distance, a very safe distance. I'll talk about that in a second. But
we're in Alyssa's garage. This is actually the French Laundry model of podcasting. You remember when he was, we have one large window open. He was like, it's not
if you look back at the photos of the French Laundry, there were glass doors and they were closed. I mean, it was very clear.
I would like to, some people would say, let's not litigate this forever, but I actually would like to.
I should have said, if you recall the French Laundry photos.
Ooh.
Let's tell some LA stories.
Let's do it. I'll go first since I was gone last week. And so you taped on the 4th of July, right? Or no, you taped on the 3rd of July.
It was the 3rd.
Right, so it had just started to ramp up. So we went up to the mountains, to Idlewild, where there are no fireworks allowed for real. And you really aren't any, I didn't hear a single one. Like not even like an errant M80 or a truck being exploded by the local police. I will say the coverage of what happened in South LA was better from the Riverside County publications than it was from the headlines.
What was the distinction?
It was just like LAPD.
You could hear it over there. Like, what was that?
It was like the papers were like, LAPD screwed this up. And like, that was the headline for the paper. But you could literally stand on the 4th of July up on the top of these mountains and see the fireworks, probably like in Hemet, I think is what we were seeing, as those little tiny starbursts that you see like from a plane. And that's how I think I want to do it from now going forward.
It should be like the Olympics. It should just be like the fireworks place in America where everyone can see them from kind of their own location.
Or how about just above? Just very small fireworks from now on. Just very tiny ones. We, you know, just these little guys.
Did you get a sense in Idlewild, like, are the penalties much harsher? Like, did they like warn you about how much trouble you would get in?
I think the fear is just existential because you're looking out at like these charred hillsides. Yeah. And there was a fire not too far away. It was about 45 miles away and there was a lot of smoke. And then, every once in a while you'd hear the fire trucks. I don't know what they were doing. Maybe they, you know, going to help or doing something. And then there was that like,
know we're here.
On edge, you know, I was doing like the evacuation plan as soon as we got to where we were staying and made sure everybody had the fire hose or the garden hose ready outside just in case, you know.
It's funny. I mean, I guess I can pivot to my LA story here, but I too was in the mountains on July 4th or on the 3rd to 4th, but just locally in the Angeles Forest. But same big fear. So we were at a campground, developed campground, the Chalao campground, which there is a fire station right there. So that was kind of my solace. I'm like, okay, well, in the event any of these, you know, 4th of July parties start setting off fireworks, you have the station right there. But then as I was going to sleep on the 4th, and like this is like Chalao campground's pretty deep into the Angeles Forest. It's not even in the front. But like as I'm going to sleep, it's like 10:30 at night, and you can hear this low rumbling off in the distance of what I can only assume were the fireworks from Metro Los Angeles.
Wow.
Kind of like, I mean, it's like, I mean, I don't know, it's like at least four or five miles like back from the Front Range. And like you could still hear them. And I was just like, it's just the same nonstop, like just thump, 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 thump way out. And then obviously, the sun rises, go for a little hike, you get up to the little like summit, and then you can see the like just the filth of the smoke blanketing. You can't see the city, you can just see the smoke. And like mercifully, like we're far enough in the mountains that the air is still clear up there. But then it's you descend down La Cañada and it's like, oh, we are in the smoke now. And here it is. And you know what? It looks fine. You know, it's just a little filtered light. It looks pretty. But I guess I'll just remain with my mask on. But it was so weird to hear the fireworks that far, that deep into the forest, which is like, I don't know. I mean, Aaron Mendelson had the tweet saying, as he flew, a KPCC reporter, he what did he refer to it as? A preposterous amount of fireworks as he was flying in, which I think preposterous is the correct word, which, like, I like fireworks. They're fun. I went on a bike ride last week to the fireworks party ride for Chief Luna's, and that was great. They're fun. But also, I'm like, I can't reconcile the, like, funness with the, like, lasting damage to lungs. Mm-hmm. So that's, like, my own personal conflict here.
I was on the ground. I didn't flee to the mountains or take my personal plane.
You survived.
To the sky like Aaron Mendelson did.
Yeah, what is it? He's flying around. That's amazing.
It was not as intense as last year, the fireworks. And the air was not as bad.
You don't think
day.
It was as bad as last year?
I don't.
Hmm.
I do not. Even like the like July 3rd, like the days leading up to it, this is just going by vibes. It felt mellower. It didn't. I remember like kind of like waking up at 2 a.m. and like being surprised that the fireworks were not still going. Where last year, I feel like they really did go all night.
For a month.
Yes.
Actually.
Yeah. Right?
Nothing else to do.
Yeah. Yesterday, my LA story, big day yesterday with Sela. I helped bring four people into a new Project Room Key hotel shelter. Some of the participants we've been working with the longest with Sela. It was a really beautiful thing to be a part of. Such a wide range of experiences for people, like some that have been wanting to get into shelter for so long, have really been working hard to do this and were just like brought to tears by what a significant event this was for them. Others who had really significant vulnerabilities, but like still the transition from living in a flood overflow channel in the LA River into a hotel room, as much as they like want this and have been working toward it, that transition is tough. It's difficult to actually make that move. You know, it feels significant in a way that people were kind of like having trouble grappling with a little bit. But so like that was a really amazing thing. And then did van outreach for the rest of the day and saw a body under the Myra and Sunset overpass from a person experiencing homelessness who had either jumped or fallen off the overpass and was just lying in the middle of the street. Have not figured out the person's identity yet, but the fire department said that it was someone that they had sort of known who was homeless in the area. So, you know, bit like some of the biggest highs and lows that I have experienced in this, like in doing this kind of thing. Overall, I would say just like watching a new resource open up and watching it just like fill with people that I know, like knowing like the exact impact that this will have, thinking about these people like being in a bed and watching TV at night instead of like the places where I know they were on the street before was just like a very, very powerful experience. So it was like overall, it was a very good day yesterday. We have other big events to
substantial
get into, very substantial events. They succeeded in making this like anticlimactic, right? Because
we were laughing because they waited for Friday, which is like ensured that although a lot of the appointments have been made on a Friday. Okay. Does anyone guess what we're talking about? What could possibly have happened?
We got word on Friday that the mayor of Los Angeles, Eric Garcetti, the Meg himself, has been nominated by Joe Biden to be the next U.S. ambassador to India.
That's not his title.
What is it?
It's really long and ridiculous.
What is it?
Did you see it?
No.
Matt shared the official White House release. It's very...
Oh, God. Let's see. Should have this queued up.
I know. Wait. Oh, no. Now I really want to say it. I've never said it out loud. Eric M. Garcetti, nominee for Ambassador Extraordinary and Plenipotentiary to the Republic of India. Did I say that word right?
Plenipotentiary? I've never heard it before.
What does it mean?
I don't know, but we need like trumpets in the background for that.
Wow. this, I mean, we first got a rumor that this was maybe going to happen months ago, then confirmation from Axios that Joe Biden was intending to nominate Mayor Garcetti over a month ago. And then from there, I just nothing but rumors like today's the day, the announcement's coming today, or the it's not going to happen anymore because of the various scandals around the mayor's staff.
I mean, there was a substantial amount of that this past week,
just
too.
This week, exactly. Yeah.
And then at the very end of it, it's we get the announcement that he's actually going.
That he is actually going, or at least he's being, like, this, it feels like it will never be final, but he is being nominated for Senate approval with the backlog at the Senate. The mayor himself was saying that this could take weeks to months.
And one of those stories that, you know, there was like, I think multiple stories the day before the nomination was announced, another round of pretty serious allegations from these depositions that have been made public, one from Naomi Seligman, who talked about multiple instances of where she witnessed behavior from Jacobs.
She's a former comms director.
Former comms director.
Garcetti.
Went to supposedly the chief of staff, Anna Guerrero, who was a whole other
on leave for Facebook comments.
Yes. And again, talked about this. I think she described it as a mafia-like culture where you are supposed to toe the line. And if you don't, you know, kind of get shunned from the administration. And then another story from KPCC from Libby Denkman that talked about one of the staffers in another deposition where acknowledging from the deposition that the mayor got involved in the situation, saying Garcetti said something to the effect of, you know, stop it or cut it out, which was interesting because the White House, Dakota Smith, went back to them and said, you know, what about all these allegations? And the White House kind of reiterated that we heard that the mayor had never witnessed any of these situations from happening. So we do have maybe this same cyclical conversation going into these Senate confirmations, but it doesn't seem like the White House really cares that much about it. I don't know.
And there was another story. We talked a couple weeks ago about the controversy within the fire department over the firing of one fire commissioner and the attempted removal of another one by the Garcetti office to... like claims by people in by the fire commissioners and people within the fire department that this was done at the behest of the fire union because these fire commissioners were antagonists of the union and were pushing for more women to be hired in the department and things like that. There's a big article in the LA Times this week by James Randi and Dakota Smith about the culture within the fire department, women who said they left because of cruel leadership and misogynistic coworkers. And this was something at the beginning of Garcetti's administration that he had really championed as something that he was going to work on. When he showed up, women made up 2.9% of the fire department, and now it's 3.5% 8 years later. And this has it's been a long fight with members of the union, with others, in order to like increase the ranks of women in this body. So kind of one story after another coming out this week, but culminating in the big one.
And then on Friday. Yes. Yeah. So it's like, and then there was one more too. You wanted to talk about the other, KPCC.
Just from Aaron Mendelson at KPCC, that Garcetti's closely aligned with the Carpenters Union, and Rick Jacobs has continued to receive pretty lucrative payments from the Carpenters Union. I believe the number was $200,000 over the last several months, including time since Garcetti has at least publicly distanced himself from Rick Jacobs. Officially, they haven't communicated since, I believe, late last year, but he's still receiving a bucket load of money from a staunchly pro-Garcetti labor union.
So we've got, all these stories hit day after day. And then Friday, we have a noon on the dot, I feel like, the story goes out. And the mayor issues a statement, which I found kind of puzzling. And then I'll read a few. I can read the whole thing if you'd like. I don't think we have any recordings of him saying that, but I love Los Angeles. I will always be an Angeleno. I want you to know that every day I am your mayor, I will continue to lead this city like it is my first day on the job. Yeah, he's been saying the every day that I'm your mayor for the beginning of a second term, I feel like. I've committed my life to service as an activist, a teacher, a naval officer, a public servant, and if confirmed, next is as an ambassador. Part of that commitment means that when your nation calls, you answer that call. Huh? Does it? If I should be confirmed, I'll bring the same energy, commitment, and love for the city to my new role and will forge partnerships and connections that will help Los Angeles.
The when they call, you answer that call is something that he's been saying for a really long time, but it's taken on a different, a less literal meaning.
Yes.
Because it used to be when the president calls you literally on the telephone, you answer that call.
Or when the presidential candidate, it was when Biden was a candidate calls.
And I do have some questions about how being the ambassador to India is going to help Los Angeles in the long run, or if that is even part of the strategy, which I have I'm not quite sure of that trajectory, but I do want to play a clip from, he gave a bunch of interviews to TV journalists in the afternoon after this happened. And I just want to play this conversation he had with Alex Michelson from Fox 11.
And when he called and he said, I need you, I kind of stopped in my tracks.
Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti describes a call from President Biden asking him to become the U.S. ambassador to India.
I don't think India when I see Eric Garcetti. Why India?
Well, you'd have to ask the president what his thinking is. But, this is one of the top handful of countries and relationships. Our oldest democracy in the world is the United States. The largest democracy in the world is India.
Garcetti says he started traveling to India as a teen.
In college, my college roommate's father became the U.S. ambassador to India. So I've stayed at the embassy and spent time there. I studied Hindi and Urdu in college. I studied the religion and culture of India.
Garcetti still needs to be approved by the Senate, where accusations of inappropriate behavior by his staffers may be brought up. Garcetti plans to remain as L.A. mayor until he's confirmed.
And I think a lot of people hear the announcement today. They're like, oh, he's gone.
Right.
I'm showing up tomorrow. I'm showing up next week. I'm showing up next month. It takes some months for the confirmation process to play out. And if confirmed, I wouldn't be leaving till sometime in the fall.
So he did actually leave the state hours after saying that on the news.
The biggest thing in there, he's been to the house.
He
slept
there.
Over.
Yes. Okay. So his friend in college, he was where? In the
Columbia?
He went to Columbia.
Or was it when he was doing something? Anyway, his friend.
And England schools.
Rhodes scholars. Yeah. Whatever. His friend's dad was the ambassador. So he's already been to this palatial residence. If you've seen, I post pictures of this like every few days on Twitter, the Roosevelt House, very famous Edward Durrell Stone residence that has just been recently renovated. So he's been there and he's
that was
there
wild.
Yes.
I can't believe we hadn't heard that previously, but I guess the reason we haven't is because he hasn't really talked about this job at all.
And there's no real connection, and he has no explanation for why he should be picked for this, except it's the largest democracy.
The fact that he studied Hindi and Urdu in college, that was a surprise. I mean, like...
So he is qualified, you're saying.
Well, you only have so many... I think you only need one language credit. Like, he studied both of those languages. Like, that was surprising
to
me.
Well, you'd wonder if that you wouldn't just be the ambassador to Mexico then.
Look, yeah, it is a
based
big
on your language.
When he says you have to ask the president, like, it's a really big, as diplomatic jobs go, this is one of the biggest in terms of like both negotiating like international relations and trade possibilities.
So you think it will benefit LA is what you're saying?
I think that there are very specific relationships that could benefit. They'll send a trade delegation, I'm sure, that might be more favorable because of who the ambassador is.
Somebody was making jokes about, like, if he works so well with Trump and Villanueva, he'll be fine with working with Modi.
Does it have a more substantial impact on LA than being the mayor of LA would? Probably not. I don't think so. But I'm sure there are some connections.
Does he get immunity? If he's if the Senate confirms him, does he receive, there's like a perjury potentiality here?
I don't
right?
think for, I think only for it's what happens in India.
Right. It's not vice versa.
Right.
Just thoughts question. I have. No, I don't know, because like, I don't know if there's a, misalignment in like what was said in the depositions between Eric Garcetti and many people around Eric Garcetti.
But I don't know.
Yeah. Open question.
So yeah, I have some questions. But my biggest question is, on Friday we hit 1,000 cases. The day this was announced, we hit 1,000 COVID cases, the highest that we've had in months, 3 months at least. A Delta variant from India. What happens if the crisis starts to spiral out of control again? Because that was his reason for not leaving before. So if things get really bad and people start dying again in larger numbers, they have to continue to die, what happens? What happens to that promise he made to the city?
What promise? There was no promise.
He did. He said he would stay.
Yeah, but he forgot about it. So.
There was another call.
There was a call. Yeah,
there was a call.
Call to action. Hire service.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's maybe part of, not the reason, but like the fact that this is like, with the announcement this week, it felt like the gears just started turning for like setting up the replacement. And so I think no matter what, the message will be like, well, like we've begun, we're in good hands. The interim mayor, like, so the next steps are figuring out who's going to be mayor when Garcetti leaves. And people talk about like, well, the city council president, Nuri Martinez, will become acting mayor as soon as he's gone. But because of this cushion, this time for advanced planning, we'll basically know who the actual interim mayor is going to be. And in the meantime, you're going to see a bunch of people announcing that they're running for mayor. Like that's what's really beginning now is the holdouts, the Kevin DeLeons and Mark Ridley Thomases and probably Nuri Martinez's who have been like waiting to jump into the race. That'll kind of happen now. And then the consensus will crystallize around like, okay, well, you're running for mayor, so you can't be interim mayor. We'll choose a consensus person. I still think it's going to be Paul Krikorian, who will fill this role for the next year. I heard people saying like, is there going to be a special election? No, there's like, we're just going to have the election as planned. And they're going to pick a steady hand on the wheel for
which we're less less than a year out from the first primary election anyway.
Yeah.
Like it's occurring as we speak. Like people are fundraising and campaigning, and yeah, I mean, I guess it's just turn that dial up more right now.
Yeah, so it's the campaign really really begins now because of this.
And in the meantime, too, you know, I started to have some high level stress on Friday because there has been a mass exodus of staffers leaving and kind of on the down low. I mean, not the high ranking officials in the LA city hall, you know, hierarchy, but a lot of like just regular people who have been there for a long time and done great work. So are we going to have this like hollowed out government? Is the next person going to start appointing a bunch of people? You know what? I just started to worry because there were already like all these retirements and buyouts and people are having trouble getting things done. Like say if they're trying to get, you know, plans approved on their, you know, little construction projects. So I just started to really worry. We need somebody that's like hyper attentive more than this mayor has been since he's been kind of checked out over the last few months.
That's why I feel like rather than if COVID gets more severe, the mayor's saying like, okay, I can't leave right now. The exodus has been in process for so long that starting to build up the incoming administration, the interim administration, I think is more important right now for the city than undoing it. We've even had already like emergency unretirements. Rich Llewellyn, the CIO, had to come back in to be acting chief of staff.
I like emergency unretirement.
Yes.
Let's do that.
But yeah, so moving on, there's been a story that locally hasn't been, it's been covered a little bit in local news, but internationally, it's been a pretty significant story. And I'm talking about, it revolves around the legal rights of transgender people to be free from discrimination and then We Spa. So the background is that late in June, a woman posted a video to Instagram, basically of her. It's her at accosting the desk attendant at We Spa. She was angry over allegedly seeing a transgender woman in the women's section of the spa, including specifically what she was angry about was seeing male appearing genitalia. So it's like a 4-minute video on Instagram, and it's basically her throwing a fit in the lobby of We Spa, which If you don't know what We Spa is, it's a Korean spa in central Los Angeles, kind of like the Westlake Koreatown borderlands. And it's a there's sections of the spa that are closed, but there's also sections of the spa that are nude. So there's nude people around everywhere inside. And so the video is basically her spouting a lot of like the sort of boilerplate anti-trans nonsense. But then this video, it ricocheted a whole bunch around conservative news media. And then on June 29th, it was picked up by Tucker Carlson. And Tucker Carlson ran a like 5-minute segment on his show interviewing somebody who was like, oh, she's great to like speak her mind and whatever. And then it got posted on Fox News's website with the headline, Transgender Individual Walks into Female Section of an LA Spa in Front of Women and Children. Now, there's a bunch of different threads on this, but basically what happened in the days since Tucker Carlson blasted it to national media is that it culminated on July 3rd. So We Spa was targeted by far-right activists, anti-trans activists, there were QAnon people present, and it basically there was a whole street demonstration at We Spa. So you had right-wing activists, and then there were left-wing activists, defenders of transgendered civil rights, coming together in front of We Spa. There was a street fight, more or less. And then there was a huge, and then the LAPD riot police also showed up in a pretty significant number, too. There might have been more police than there were demonstrators, as happens, but
two people were stabbed.
Two people were stabbed. There was video of stabbing. There was batonings. There were pepper sprays. It didn't appear
the stabbings were by one anti-trans protester. One victim was a counter-protester. The other was a friendly stabbing incident by accident, I guess.
But that didn't stop the conservative Twitter world from saying that, oh, one of our defenders of traditional American values was stabbed at this protest
of course,
Antifa. And yeah, this just, it what's no, what to me, like there's so many threads, right? And I think, also just to clarify that, like since 2005, California law has prohibited transgender discrimination in public. Like it is a state law, and then it's also something that the federal Supreme Court has declined to change, even very recently. But like the thing to me is that in the week like before this happened is that there was also a pretty lengthy Washington Post article about how there's an uptick in sort of street violence in Los Angeles of a political nature like this. So, and this is something that I know we've talked about before on here, but it's like you had the anti-vax demonstration that shut down the Dodger Stadium vaccination site for a long time. And I think the dissonance for me is that we have a story. So like the We Spa story has made international headlines in like the UK, in Korea, in the United States, in the conservative world. And then like local media, it's like there was a LA Times editorial board letter that said transgender people should be free from discrimination in public spaces. Sure. There was a brief news, there was just like the boilerplate, like an event has occurred coverage that like occurred in like broadcast as well as the written media. But like that was it. Meanwhile, you have this as an international story elsewhere. And I'm just like, the thing that I'm trying to think about is like how do we as media, LA podcast, I guess included, like start covering this more because like it's happening and like you have these like street fights that are so influential in media, but like locally, like if I was to talk to, I don't know, a number of my family members, they might not even know that something like this happened or like is happening.
And like, also may not have happened.
It also may not have
the happened. Original event. I mean, I think this is a really important aspect of like you talk about how this was seized on in conservative media in particular, both the existence of a trans person in the spa and then the ensuing conflict in the streets. But both We Spa and LAPD say that there is no evidence that there was a trans person at We Spa that day. Not because We Spa denies that they do accept trans people. They just said that like there were no other witnesses and none of their trans clients were there that they're aware of, which suggests that this was kind of the plan from the beginning. Post this video, have a protest, draw a counter protest, get in conflict in the streets, have Glenn Greenwald and whoever else say, like, look at this is leftist hypocrisy in action. They're trying to, like, silence people's speech on this stuff or whatever. The fact that that is the goal and seems to have kind of played out what these individuals, if it were manufactured, would be considered a success, I guess, does make you wonder, like, what is the level of response coverage that this kind of thing deserves if it can, if this didn't happen, we have no evidence that it did beyond this video. If it can just be spun up out of nothing, then yeah, what is the responsibility of a coverage organization to acknowledge it or not?
But then I go back to what happened with, say, the vaccination clinic shutdown, which became a story that was like, what do these people want and why do they want it? They're so silly. Oh, these funny, quirky anti-vaxxers, like, oh, they are just failed Hollywood people like you and me, just trying to get some attention. And I think I worry too that maybe you're right, Hayes, giving too much attention is bad, you know, no matter what it is, because that's just what they want. But then again, it's like, as is shown, these people are dangerous. Like, it's very easy to just, you know, poke fun at these alt-right folks and try to make it be like this is just another typical clash that happens, like, with protesting or something like that on the street. And it is not the reality that we are facing. And especially when you go to look at some of the things that have happened, like, in Orange County, you know, a lot of where it's like, I think a much bigger rally, a much bigger turnout. I mean,
it's
a consistent
organizing show at the Board of Supervisors meeting. But
I mean, I don't know the answer to this, but the question is, like, are they made more dangerous with coverage?
Right.
If it's a handful of goofballs blocking the gates to the vaccine clinic, and there's stories plastered all over about how, like, the city and LAPD, like, shut this down and they were silenced, is it more people next time because of the coverage? Or if you just kind of move these people along and, like, you do try to kind of ignore it, does that choke it off? Does that make them less effective? Like, I don't. No.
I mean, I can't speak for what's going through news directors' minds, like, locally, but the effect was there was very little coverage of it, at least locally in Los Angeles, other than just an event occurred in Westlake. But I mean, I think a lot about how there's been, I can't tell you who did the research, but I remember there's a pretty substantial media research world from media scholars that have made the point that, like, the decline of local news media across the country, specifically the erasure of, like, local op-ed pages at locally owned newspapers, has fueled, like, as local, like, you have like viewpoints articulated by people in, you know, like, I don't, the Cleveland Plain Dealer, that's always the example. So you have like a relatively small metro area with, like, opinion voices that are rooted in that metro area, basically calling BS on, like, things happening in that local area. And that is a substantial, and the effect being, and the scholarship basically says that local perspective, even though it's an opinion perspective, not even a hard news perspective, is key in making sure that people who are reading and consuming this media, like, have a just better sense of what's going on. Contrast now, where local news media, newspapers, and TV, I mean, I'm sure you've probably seen that, like, Sinclair Broadcasting John Oliver segment where they sync everything up and it's the same terrifying segment that runs everywhere in the country. But, like, in the vacuum created by no local news media standing back and calling nonsense on things like this occurring, is that then it gets, and then it just gets amplified. Then the, like, Facebook machine, like, augments, like, the whatever, like, whatever's happened here, the Glenn Greenwaldism, like, oh, the left is trying to silence free speech, share now, and it goes from there. And, like, locally, like, there was no institutional media really I don't think I have seen there. The only the what you're talking about, like that, whether or not the original incident occurred, maybe like was the woman who posted the initial video that went viral on Instagram just making it up?
And it doesn't really matter, right?
Because no,
it's the existence of this sentiment and the protest itself that was primarily covered.
But no local media has like scrutinized that.
Right.
To start, which is like the logical starting point. And the coverage is from a queer publication called the Los Angeles Blade, mm-hmm. which is where that scrutiny is coming from mm-hmm. right now, which is not being done by any of the significantly powerful right. broadcast or print institutions locally, which is, well, now we have an international story, but right. like nobody in Los Angeles, the place where this story is actually taking place, is particularly aware of it.
Well, maybe the way forward is analyzing the flow of this story is a kind of coverage to say who is this person who originally posted this? Like, what evidence do we have that this was designed to generate pushback? Where did it first kind of appear on social media and in conservative media? Like, tracking the progress of a story like this that is sort of potentially viral marketing to understand how these movements work a little more clearly, you can simultaneously delegitimize them and also acknowledge that this is real, that this is an actual phenomenon that is deserving of attention. But that is something that it feels like it is really not happening, because like even if the story were covered, what we would get is exactly like you're saying, there was a protest here, this is what the two sides were saying, and this is how many people got stabbed.
Well, in the meantime, as a longtime Wii Spa goer, I have not been back since the pandemic, since they reopened, and I am so pleased to know of their support of their trans clients that I will be going there as often as possible, and I encourage our other listeners to do the same.
They didn't fold at all.
Yeah, it was really.
Wii Spa is firmly in the inclusive spaces, or like encourages mm-hmm. it and makes a distinct effort to be inclusive to everybody.
Yeah,
which that was one of my last pre-pandemic visits. It was mm-hmm. I went to Portos and Wii Spa a couple days before we shut down.
Well, this, I guess, will take us with no transition I can possibly think of. There's a lot of tall buildings in the Wilshire corridor mm-hmm. that you might want to check out next time you go to any establishment there. Was that good? I don't know.
Fine. Leave it in.
Over the last few weeks, we've been watching this horrible tragedy unfold in Surfside, Florida, with the collapse of the Champlain Towers South structure. Just this past week, they did a controlled demolition of the second part of the building that hadn't fallen down in this collapse that happened at the end of June. I believe the number of people that they have recovered is 85 now. Deceased people is 85. There's still probably under 100 people still missing. That number goes down every day as they did that demolition. They're able to recover more bodies. It's just really going to go down as, I think, the largest deadliest building failure in U.S. history. Not an accidental, I guess, mm-hmm. compared to something like 9/11. And in researching this story, I found a lot. I wrote a story for Curbed that I've been updating just with all the theories, because at the very beginning, it was kind of unclear why this could possibly happen. It's a 40-year-old building. It had stayed up this long. What makes a building suddenly collapse? And in researching this story, I found actually a lot of parallels with some dangers that we're facing here in Los Angeles that don't get talked about very often. Of course, we have earthquake risk, but there are some other factors, particularly with how this building fell down, that I thought we should talk about. And just to quickly go over kind of like the latest theories, I think people saw right away that there had been this report in 2018 that they had commissioned. This is a condo building, so this is an HOA that has to make these types of decisions, where they had shown some really serious corrosion and spalling, which is when the cement and concrete columns were cracking and flaking. You know, you can see this in all these videos where somebody had gone into the subterranean parking garage and seen all this water damage that they thought was perhaps from the increase in high king tide of flooding that is happening in Miami more often due to sea level rise, but just a general awareness that some repairs needed to be made. And then they were delayed and delayed and delayed. And then a series of very urgent requests earlier this year to get the repairs started. And then the building fell down. And it's to say that there isn't probably going to be one thing that brought the building down, but it's going to be a combination of perhaps construction flaws and administrative failures and city responsibilities that were not followed up on. But we do have some of these same issues here in Los Angeles, namely that a lot of our building stock was built around the same time and with similar, perhaps, I don't want to say they definitely cut corners, but...
I mean, for anything like this to happen, like you just said, you have to have, like, I guess, a perfect storm of different things aligning. You need to have a poor construction. You need to have poor maintenance. You need to have, like, inaction on, like, a circumstance that, well, maybe we should have acted on. But, like, all of that is to say is, like you just said, there's a lot of, like, buildings from the 50s and 60s and 70s here in Los Angeles that, like, many of them have been maintained very well. Many of them probably haven't. And like there is by virtue of there being earthquakes here, like the building codes here have been revised a number of times, usually after, like most notably like after the 1971 earthquake and after the 1994 Northridge earthquake. But like all of that is incumbent on the code, like having a good code is only as good as like how well people are inspecting the code and how quickly like deviations from that code, if they're one picked up on, and two, like how quickly they're resolved, which that's where it's like, I mean, I think as I think about like building, like when I was more or less as a housing reporter, like I went into a bunch of really crappy buildings in Los Angeles. Like there's tons of buildings, tons of large apartment buildings that aren't even like big concrete or big steel buildings that are just in very bad shape. So I think a lot about, there's a building in Westlake where tenants went on rent strike, but like it was a building, it was a four story wood podium, wood, like four stories of wood on top of a concrete parking podium. And the building had been built with bad plumbing. There was another building by the same builder that somebody litigate, like one of, like, I think the owner sued the original building. This was in the early 90s. They sued the owner or the builder saying that you built really bad plumbing into this building. And there was a settlement, but then this was another building that was built in the same sort of same way, but there was never any litigation for this particular building in Westlake. And the effect is that like the plumbing's been leaking inside since it was built in the late 80s. And like, as I'm walking through the building, you can touch walls all over the place. They're wet to the touch. The roof was like wet. It was squelchy under my foot. And like the entire building was soft, which is like not good. That is, strictly speaking, a like Department of Building and Safety issue. But like how inspection works, or at least as my understanding at the time was when I tried to learn more about, well, how do we have a building that seems to have been rotting from the inside out 30 years on, still like fit for occupancy for, it was a 200 unit building, it's huge. And so when I went to check with the Housing Community Investment Department, in theory, one of the agencies that's like checking this stuff up, it's like, yeah, we can like cite for mold. So if there's like mold on the wall, right, that indicates that there is a leak behind the wall that is causing there to be mold, So what HCID can do is we can cite and say, well, there's mold here, so the landlord has to fix the mold. A slumlord is going to just paint over that mold and call it a day. And if the inspector comes back and says, well, I can't see mold, problem solved. Practically though, the actual issue of like the plumbing that has been leaking and the underlying rot inside the building is still not been fixed. It's still going on. And like, to the point that it's like, okay, well, as I'm in that building, I'm like, I mean, I'm not a structural engineer, but if the wood inside holding this building up has been rotting for the last 30 years, like I would not want to, like, it's not a building that, like, should be an earthquake risk, but, like, I would not want to be in a building that has, like, that significant water damage throughout it, especially over several decades in an earthquake situation, or even at all, because, like, distinct, structural capability, like, the structural situation, it's, like, there's mold everywhere inside the building. And, like, to fix the plumbing, though, you need to be aware of the plumbing. And that is something that HSID told me that, well, this is, like, that's not, if we can't see it, like, if the wall hasn't collapsed, which in this particular building, walls were collapsing all the time. So it's like, if the wall collapses, then you can see the leaking plumbing and then you can fix it. But mold is not, at least as our sort of regulatory situation is right now, enough to, like, regulate it, which is, like, kind of a deviation from what you were just talking about insofar as, like, it's not a big concrete building, but, like, it's how things like this slip under the cracks. So, like, maybe the situation in Florida, and this is purely my own speculation, but, like, maybe in a situation like this, it's like, well, there's water pooling here. So I guess if we, you know, alleviate the issue of, like, water pooling here and we fix the drain, okay, problem solved. But, like, it doesn't change the fact that, like, that concrete has been, I don't know if rotting is the word for concrete, but, like, the concrete has been deteriorating for the past 35 years that, like, the water was pooling here before we fixed the drain situation.
Of course.
Like,
and they just added pumps, of course, because that's what you do in Florida. I mean, and your point is I think extremely valid, because who lives in these buildings, right? And who has the legal recourse to be able to go to the city or make a claim against, you know, a developer or a landlord in this situation? And we have a really interesting setup, I think, here in California, where if you live in a condo building, you cannot sue the developer or bring any legal recourse against them for 10 years after the building is finished. So here's what happens with a lot of these buildings. They get built. You might notice something, but you can't do anything until 10 years is up. You get fed up, you move out, the building converts to, say, an apartment building, and then you have no legal recourse, even less legal recourse or power to be able to, you know, attack some of these problems that could maybe not have a building spontaneously collapse, but it could make it more vulnerable when we do have the earthquake, which is all but inevitable going to happen, that we're going to have a bigger one than Northridge in the next 30 years.
This is relevant to this week in another way, which is increasing earthquake safety standards was cited in a lot of the articles about Garcetti and his successes over his administration. There were changes. How did that actually play out?
So this was really, really interesting. When I was reporting the story, one of the engineers I talked to, when I mentioned I was in LA, they were like, oh, well, you have the same problem, you know, because you have these steel moment frame skyscrapers, and which is basically just a fancy word for a steel skyscraper. It has a special kind of welding joint, yeah. Steel moment frame. It just sounds very dramatic, like steel moments.
Welds that can fail in an earthquake.
Welds that were thought to be very safe until Northridge happened. And now the city got very alarmed, especially because of discovery they made at the Getty. There's an amazing story by Jenna Chandler about what happened at the Getty after Northridge, where they had thought they had engineered this building for a much stronger earthquake, and went in the next day and saw that some of the welds had indeed cracked. And if it wasn't for the resources of the Getty, I don't even think we would have discovered this at all. I just remember Jenna reporting the story and sitting next to her and her face just, like, blanching when she's talking to the engineer. So we have a number of these buildings. It is basically every skyscraper in downtown that was constructed, you know, 80s, 90s, you know, before Northridge. We've changed the way we build them here for newer buildings. A lot of things are different now. But I think the key thing was that after Northridge happened, you know, people went to the city and said, hey, we really need to do something about these. They don't actually still know how many of them need to be fixed. I looked up now to see if there is any more updates on this count. Santa Monica has actually done a really good job going through and making sure they know which buildings were vulnerable and have made changes. But this is something, again, that comes out of this legacy. Dr. Lucy Jones, friend of the show, we've had her on, was named the city seismologist by Garcetti to, in part, make some very stricter recommendations for the city. And even at the state level, those did not pass. What we have now is a life safety requirement, and you want a reusable building requirement, which is a very fancy way to say that buildings will fall down in the next earthquake. And she says 10% of tall buildings we should expect to have some kind of catastrophic failure.
What's tall?
The skyscraper. So, I mean, I would say like 12.
A steel high rise.
So like, yeah, 12 stories and higher, just the same height of this, the Surfside building. Wow. We should expect them to fall down. She says it very, you know, matter of factly,
yeah.
But, and one of the things, again, that this engineer told me that I talked to was that there was a plan, there was an idea, I guess, not a plan, to take the steel moment frame skyscrapers, especially in downtown. This was the time when we were starting to talk about adaptive reuse in a very serious way and say, hey, these aren't really fit for offices anymore. You know, let's just go ahead and rehab them and turn them into housing. Well, that, you know, affordable housing, you know, mm-hmm. that didn't actually happen, but maybe if there aren't as many people going to work downtown anymore, or if, you know, patterns are actually changing, that might be a really smart way to take this problem and address it head on for our next mayor.
Jacob Margolis wrote about this in LAist a few weeks ago too, who does the Big One podcast, if you really want to keep freaking out about this stuff.
They focused on the Arco Towers, the twin buildings, yeah, on Flower that are vulnerable in this way. As many, I think they were built in 1974 or something like that. But
I want to stay in the Alyssa canon. Alyssa wrote this week a controversial piece about efforts by residents of Venice, a neighborhood that we've spent a lot of time in on this show, to stop a big new Starkitect designed project near the Venice canals. And how these are the same residents, in many cases the exact same people, who have been cheering in recent weeks Sheriff Alex Villanueva's threats to clear the beach by July 4th. Alyssa, talk about your piece and I also want to talk about the reaction to your piece.
Well, let's talk first about what didn't happen on July 4th, because I think it's important to note that the escalation has kind of been diffused, at least for the moment. I know we talked about this for the last few weeks, but Mike Bonin, council member for the area, came up with his own plan, which was this encampment to home initiative, which has been done in a few other places in the city before, notably at another place in his district. And said, you know, I'm going to get the money and get people to at least temporary housing, everybody on the boardwalk who accepts it. And then there is like kind of a rolling deadline of when the beach is being cleared. And actually, there's a lot fewer tents than there were even a few weeks ago. If you go down there, it's kind of a rolling from the south to the north, right? Mm-hmm. I'm trying
up to the Santa Monica.
Up to the Santa Monica border.
And it's still playing. I've been volunteering for Mike Bonin in different capacities, not on this project. But they're saying right now that 104 people have been brought inside as of Friday. But at the same time, there has been a lot of pain associated with this project where parts of the beach have had people moved into shelter and all the tents cleared away. But then new tents are coming in, and there have been video by the LA Times reported on it. Citizen journalists have been out there documenting how people are being told to leave those parts of the beach at 2 a.m., which is when the beach closes. So you have all this footage of LAPD and sanitation in the middle of the night, having people move 100 yards away. So it's been like a tough project with a lot of different facets to it. So anyway, this is they just extended the deadline, right, to give St. Joseph Center, the service provider, more time to get people in. But this is happening within the context of this story that you wrote.
And I'll start by just talking about the woman that I, you know, spoke with, who was someone who did get into a motel temporary situation, because it was just as much the law enforcement deadline that was starting to frighten her as the way that homeowners had started to threaten her, kind of like this also escalating you know, situation. And also, as we said the other day, you know, a person was murdered on the boardwalk, Michael Hall. Mm-hmm. And I think they've caught someone who, a suspect. But it was getting really scary, I think, for her. She also has two sons that were with her. What I want to just bring up from our conversation, which wasn't necessarily in our story, you know, she just had felt this very strong, she had been in and out of shelter. She had been in and out of room key. They wouldn't let her and her son stay together in the same room. Now they are. So this isn't, I don't know if this is like not, it's like outside of the room key rules or something like that, where you, you know, they're just making exceptions to, you know, the offer of shelter that you are accepting when you come inside. So now she's able to stay with her sons, which is helpful to her. But I thought something that was really interesting that I just wanted to bring up was the responses to my piece and to the general, why are all these people in Venice question, which I think is something that I would really like to talk about. She said the reason that she is there is because of the mild climate, which makes her life easier for various health reasons, but also because if you go even a few miles inland, it is going to get so hot this summer that you are literally going to be burned by the pavement if you are sleeping on it. And I think this is something that I really, you know, I went to the beach this weekend. It was humid and kind of gross weather this weekend. And I went to the beach. I didn't go to Venice Beach. But I went to the beach and I was sitting there just thinking exactly that. Like, this is where we should be building all of the housing. This is where we need everybody to live, to survive. And if we wanted to actually talk about, you know, where we should or should not be putting 140 units or 140 units of housing, which is what this Rhys Davidson project would put on a parking lot that is owned by the city in the middle of Venice, a block from the beach. There's no other place we should be putting this. You know, I mean, we should be putting housing everywhere, but this is the number one spot to add as much housing as possible. And I thought about that a lot as the heat waves that have been, you know, just catastrophic. It was, I think yesterday, 130 degrees in Death Valley.
And we've been comparatively spared compared to the rest of the West Coast.
We've been fine.
Yeah. But like even farther inland, when everyone was talking about the heat wave this weekend, I checked my app and it's like 89.
So and even like the comparison I was going to make was like, instead of putting housing in the Inland Empire, for example, you need to put it in Los Angeles, in the Los Angeles basin.
But a lot of the responses you've been getting are actually put it in the Inland Empire, put it in the desert.
It's always like Antelope Valley, they say for some reason.
Where
which
it's
I don't
been
even
110 plus for the last year.
Yes, like put it in the least habitable places in the city. And they use the fact that land is so expensive in Venice. This was city-owned land that was given over to Venice Community Housing and Executive Director Becky Dennison, who you talked to for your article. And people saying, like, this land is way too expensive. Imagine how many units you could build in another place. The only core principle for a lot of the pushback is this type of housing, this type of person should not have a space to exist in Venice because it's so expensive. And part of the I see a lot of people yelling at Councilmember Bonin all the time saying, basically, like, I have worked very hard to live here and I've invested a lot in my property here, and you are threatening my just like basic financial well-being by welcoming poor people into this neighborhood. At the same time, we never talked about this. Did you see that real estate flyer that was going around a few weeks ago? Liam Dillon posted it. Here's a realtor that mailed thousands of people this flyer that said, "Bring on the homeless. We're still bringing the $1 million sales," or whatever. So just basically saying, like,
right, you heard them, bring it on. Like, let's bring them. Let's build them some realty.
This building, people also have qualms with the aesthetics, as always, of this building. This is Eric Owen Moss, who, in this case, for him, exercised admirable restraint in designing this property. Other projects of his, if you don't like them, it feels like kink shaming almost.
I mean, if you go to Conjunctive Points, which I think has like 10 different names now, if you've ever gone to Vespertine for dinner, who among us hasn't? I haven't.
I haven't.
But
no,
nobody has. But it's this, it's an office park basically that this developer has been adding on to for decades. It's like a very Winchester house vibe where they just build like more turrets and more like weird sculptures and little alcoves that are carved. It's quite interesting. And it suggests everyone go and check it out. But yeah, you're right. This is kind of like Conjunctive Points light up for the beach. But I found it, the choice of Eric Owen Moss and also the kind of the vibe. If you walk around Venice, it doesn't look like this anymore, but the older buildings from the 70s and 80s all had this whimsical bunker-like vibe to them. They've always looked like this. And Eric Owen Moss is one of the architects in this very famous photograph that was taken in 1980 on Venice Beach with all these architects that were trying to do things differently. And a lot of what they built at that time was affordable and supportive housing projects. That was like Venice's thing. But what Becky Dennison told me, which I thought was so interesting, was that they haven't been able to build ground up in 30 years, except for two times. So something has shifted. And it, you know, where the
population in Venice has declined.
Which is interesting too. Like, how could there be a housing crisis for this neighborhood if the population has actually declined? And something has shifted is a lot of these two-unit, three-unit, four-unit bungalow apartment, courtyard apartment buildings or little low-rise buildings have been turned into single-family mansions. And it's very easy to see, namely, if you walk around Oakwood Park, the recreation center right there, which was the historically Black community in Venice. It's much less Black now. And one of, for example, there's that church there, historically Black church, First Baptist Church, which Jay Penske and his wife, a model, I can't remember her name, wanted to turn this church into their mansion, which got stopped. Now it's going to be preserved. But it's just some of these like very quintessential decision-making that is happening because of this influx of a lot of money. Mm-hmm.
There was other good writing about this week. Frank Xiong at the LA Times wrote a great column about access to the beach up and down California and how it's limited in so many different ways and how difficult it is for a lot of people to get to. Every summer, I think, coming from the East Coast, I think about what beaches are like on like Cape Cod in Massachusetts and other places where they are just like choked with people, these rocky little crappy beaches that are just like overrun with people that have come to access this resource. And ours are huge. They're always just like, there's tons of space on them for people to use, but it never feels like it's like living up to its potential capacity as a resource.
And one of the arguments against this building being built, which I still haven't found a very good reason for this building not to be built, but the best
there's no good reason for it not to be built.
We need this parking lot is the big rallying cry because they don't want people to park on their streets, I guess, or, you know, come there. They actually wanted to build a even bigger parking structure instead of housing.
Which, by the way, I remember reading in your piece that the number of parking spaces that is there are going to be there, I believe it's more, right?
Oh, I'm glad you asked that, Matt. Actually, yes. In the project, it would double the number of parking spaces in the surface parking lot in the final product.
Which that's a different conversation about the development of parking and housing, but like,
yeah,
just as a material fact.
I think that's a coastal commission conversation that needs to be had. But this is, I mean, and I love that they're coming after me. Please bring it. I welcome your debates about my home and where I live. But I will say, I live near PATH. That's where we are right now. PATH is now starting work on the third high-rise supportive housing project. There are four more within two blocks of my home right now. I will help every single one of those buildings get built. I will do everything I can to talk to people about what problem they have with these being near their house. I cannot understand what would make you think that you are entitled to the land or the access to a public good that is near you, that you would be able to shut people out of it, particularly in a climate crisis.
Or that the existing arrangement of space is better for you necessarily than having a place to
And how
to
could
house
you how can
safely.
You complain if you look out your window and see tents, which I'll be honest too, our neighborhood is filled with tents. Like people think, I don't know where people seem to think that like they if in Venice they are somehow different than anywhere else in the city. You know, they point at the numbers, but again, the reason that people are in Venice is because it's on the coast and it is one of few places in LA County on the coast that is not its own city that patrols people away the moment that they sit down, which is also, I guess, what we're in for in
Coming
Los Angeles.
Soon.
Yeah.
This is a kind of a good segue for one more thing. It's fitting that in this episode where we say goodbye to Mayor Garcetti that I have a little goodbye to say as well.
Plenipotentiary.
I'm going to be
attaché.
The new extraordinary plenipotentiary attaché.
Because you once visited New Delhi.
I grew up there. I didn't, I haven't mentioned. I summered in that house. No, this is going to be my last appearance on the show in a traditional way, at least for a while. I'm going to take on some work for Councilmember Nithya Raman, not like a real city job, basically some consulting work around some of the homelessness and housing projects that office is putting together. There is a huge amount happening right now. There's supportive housing, safe parking, new shelters, sanitation and hygiene programs, storage, and I'm going to be working on building support, expanding outreach to get things like that done. This is not a cash out. It is really not very much money at all. But I've worked in a volunteer capacity with Nithya for a while, and I just think being able to represent that work in a more formal way is going to make it more effective. But since I am formally working with an elected official, I don't want to tarnish the reputation of the show by being a literal paid shill. As
I've been accused of being, even though I am not paid by the city.
As a host. So we've talked about ways I could maybe come back and chat sometimes about the work and stuff, but it won't be as a co-host the way we've done it in the past with me having any kind of like editorial influence over the show. This is really tough. Alyssa, working with you and Scott is the best thing I've ever done. And just knowing you both has enriched my life in so many ways. And I really believe in the value of this show for just like bringing people into what's happening in the city. I think it's had real effects. But from the beginning, I've always thought that I would do this until it seemed like there was a structure set up for where other people could then just kind of take my spot. And I think we have so many people now like Matt and others who will be coming in who can offer more than I can in this role. But I will really miss talking with all of you every week about this stuff. But I'm looking forward to just being able to listen, just to listen to the show and just sort of be informed by it. And I still want to do the movie show for the Patreon. I'll do more of those. So that's it for me. That's it for this episode of LA Podcast. Thank you to Brian Holmes for producing the show. Thank you to everyone for subscribing to the Patreon, patreon.com/theLAPod. And everyone else will be back next week. Bye.